Questions.
Correspondence at covenantmail.com. Sarah says, facts in response to last week's question. My fact, because there was a question about what do you know that no one else
does.
Yes. My fact many other people do not know is that Lent does not include Sundays. The reason being that you should not fast on the Lord's Day. I'm really hoping that is something neither of you knew.
I didn't know that. Absolutely did not know that.
And I get to be read out on the podcast. So if you are, I mean, this is not particularly seasonal, but if you're going to give up something for Lent, remember in future, you can partake at will on Sundays of the thing which you're abstaining from.
That is remarkable. I did not know that.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Mike in leafy East Ilsley in West Berkshire, heritage listener. I recently went for a job interview at a secondary school. This is an interesting question.
Okay.
I wanted a new challenge having been at my current school for 15 years. In the interview, I was asked about what extracurricular clubs I could offer the school. I mentioned a couple of things I could offer. And then out of nowhere, I mentioned my love of your show. The conversation went like this. Me.
Not a chance having this job.
Have you heard of the Kermode and Mayo podcast? To which the interviewer said, yes, and nodded in acknowledgement. Me. Well, I wanted to create a film review student group that centres around the Kermode and Mayo show, to which the interviewers raised their eyebrows and seemed suitably intrigued. Who knows if this answer swung it for me, but I got the job and I start in January. So my question is, having promised this in my interview, what am I going to do in my new student film review club that centres around your show? It must run for an hour each week and can go on trips every now and then. Any ideas would be
most
appreciated.
But when you said, so the show, will it be a show like this show or a show about this show? I don't quite understand that bit.
Well, I think the logic of this has to be sort of inspired by the sort of things that we do.
Yes.
Now we're going to talk about films for an hour. And obviously the trips can be trips to the cinema and choose, mm-hmm. you know, particular films that everybody wants to see. But if you're going to get together for an hour, I suppose you would... obviously, there could be some movie conversation.
Yes,
but obviously, this kind of emerged over a period of time. If it's going to be in any way kind of related to this, it's going to have to be about
a
bunch of other stuff. So, in Roger Ebert's phrase, which we talked about a lot, life itself.
Life itself.
The fact that people watch movies with their parents or their kids or their grandparents, and so therefore it becomes a cross-generational affair.
Well, I would say the key thing, not to undermine my own role in this show, is you. I would say that if you want to do something that's inspired by this, then you could. Then it's to do with what you do, which is asking the audience what they think. I mean, we say it as a joke, but we don't mean it as a joke, which is that all the best stuff we do doesn't come from us. It comes from the audience. So I would say that the key to doing it is getting people, anyone who's listening or whatever it is, to write in and tell you about what they thought about a film, what the film they've seen recently, experiences that they've had with them. Start it as a discussion of that and go from there. And what you'll find is if you get a couple of decent emails or contributors, you'll just run with that.
I mean, they won't email their own group, will they? They'll just contribute. So I think, but if you, so obviously it can start about...
Just discuss.
Yeah, films that are out, films that have been on television, that's maybe the easiest thing to do. Stuff, films that are on streaming services
that everyone can see. I'm confused. They're not doing a podcast. They're just doing... Be quiet. They're not doing a podcast. I'm just talking to my computer to go away.
No, they're having a...
They're having a discussion, but they're not recording the discussion. No. They're having a discussion about...
Well, it's going to be an after-school group, which is sort of based on the kind of thing that we do here, which seems to me to be just you talk about films that folks have seen either at the cinema or they've seen it on streaming services.
Yeah.
And then you discuss it. That has to be the heart of it. Then recommendations from stuff they've used to have seen. Yeah. And then also I think this fundamental thing, which I just think is so interesting and has run now for many years, this idea that people react to films based on what they bring to it.
Yes, take from a film what you bring to it.
And I think that's fascinating. And I think it's those kind of conversations. So you start off by saying, let's talk about, maybe they've all seen the new Marvel's film. So we talk about that. How does that compare? What other shows should we watch? If we're going to get involved, has it run its time? Is it just for a particular demographic?
Can I go back to my emails comment, which you knocked aside? I still think there is something valid in writing down, you know, in people writing things down if you bring to a group, you know, you've written something.
Yeah, if you want to write something and bring it along to the group and read it out,
yes.
That's not the same as emailing your own group.
No, but you could email the group. Oh, I don't know. Okay, fine. You're the presenter. There's a reason why you're the presenter and I'm the critic. You understood that email, which I...
Mike got the job. So, yeah. Mike, I hope we haven't confused you totally. Beverly in Colne in Lancashire. Do you have a favourite documentary film? Mark is not allowed to choose The Fear of God. Lol. My favourite is Grey Gardens. A favourite documentary film?
Yeah, I do.
I will choose two, because you always go for a double bill.
Yes.
I'm sure there are better ones that I've seen, but the first ones that came off the top of my head are They Shall Not Grow Old and the Peter Jackson film.
Yes.
And Senna.
Ooh, that's very good. Yeah, both of those are very fine choices. Mine is The Act of Killing, because I think The Act of Killing is an absolutely soul-shaking meditation on the human condition that is actually a film about, that asks in a real practical way whether or not art can be used to process trauma. And I think it is, I think it is genuinely a work of genius. I think it's a tough watch, but I think it is an absolutely astonishing movie.
Thank you, Beverly. Henry says, Dear Simon, from Mark and Simon, and Mark from Simon and Mark.
Yeah.
What is the weirdest film Simon likes? What is the goriest film that Mark likes? Thank you for the constant high-quality entertainment.
Do we answer about each other?
No. Well, you can't know what is the weirdest film that I like.
Oh, sorry, I thought that's what the question was. So again, as I just demonstrated before, Mark failing to understand the question.
I have to answer, what is the weirdest film? I mean, in general, I don't like weird films. I don't like that. So, again, maybe there are weirder things that I like, but the first thing that came off the block for me was Magnolia, which isn't weird, but it has some...
The Plague of Frogs.
Yeah, and it's sort of not straightforward storytelling, particularly Paul Thomas Anderson, one of the great Philip Seymour Hoffman performances, and maybe one of the great Tom Cruise performances as well.
And one of the great...
Julianne Moore.
And one of the great soundtracks, the scene in which everyone sings along to...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which, of course, famously wasn't written...
Wise Up.
...wasn't written for that film. It was written for Jerry Maguire and then was rejected. Did you know that?
Yeah, I've got a thing here. I'm sure I've got some more stuff about that. But anyway, yes, so I entirely agree with that. But what is the goriest film that you like?
Well, weirdly enough, and this refers back to something you just said. So your favourite documentary was Peter Jackson's They Shall Not...
Yeah, that's what I thought of, that and Senna.
Yeah, no, I'm not contradicting it. Yeah, so They Shall Not Grow Old. I think the goriest film I've ever watched, and I was trying to think of... When you said that, how can we categorize gore? And the answer would be the film that, at the time that it was made, used more blood than any other film had on record. And do you remember what the answer is?
It's the one with the lawnmower.
The one with the lawnmower. It is Brain Dead by Peter Jackson. And the scene in which the guy turns the lawnmower upside down to plow his way through a room full of zombies is absolutely jaw-dropping. And the best thing about Brain Dead is that it is so joyous. It is such a joyous film. And, you know, Jackson had wanted to make it for a long time and he hadn't been able to. And then when he did, he was just so delighted to be able to. I mean, it's fantastic. It's just an absolute joy, and I think it is the goriest film. At least, I remember writing or reading about it in Fangoria magazine at the time, that it was the most amount of stage blood used in a gore movie.
Ben in London, with child one, 14 years old, and child two, 11 years old, we're at a stage where family film night choices are running low. We seem to have exhausted the 12 rated films that will pass the group decision algorithm. One film that has failed to be screened is the church-approved Splash.
Oh.
Whenever I suggest it as a potential film, the good lady radiotherapy physicist her indoors rejects the title as just sleazy men objectifying Daryl Hannah. It's been many years since I last watched it. From your experience, can you advise how it stands up to modern viewing with a pre-teen slash teen audience?
Well, I think a pre-teen audience would be slightly difficult because... It has some jokes in it, largely delivered by John Candy, that I think probably would be like, I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, I think you'd have to be careful with that. I remember when Splash first came out. I think it was recertificated either from a U to, it's probably a 12 now, isn't it? I'm not sure. there was definitely a case when it first came out, it had a lower certificate, and that certificate has now been upped. But I don't think it is just sleazy middle-aged men objectifying Daryl Hannah. I think it's a much more complex and funny and rewarding film than that. So I'm just looking at the So the original cinema certificate was in that case it hasn't changed. The original certificate was a PG, and then I thought it had been upped. Hang on. No, it was a PG. It appears that it still is a PG, which is, okay, that's remarkable because there's definitely a couple of John Candy jokes in there that I'm surprised they are in a PG certificate film. But, you know, it is still a PG. I'm sure I've got a videotape of it. I'm misremembering. Yeah, no, I think it isn't the movie that you think it is. I think it's much funnier than that, and I think it's much cleverer than that, and I think that it isn't just a film with middle-aged men objectifying Daryl Hannah, but it's like the show when John Candy says the thing. Is there anyone here from Penthouse Magazine? In that case, we're not talking.
Benjamin from Devon. Apologies if this has been asked before on the show, but I'm going for an MRI scan next week and I'm slightly scared of being stuck in a metal tube. My parents tell me it's nothing to worry about. Is there anything you two have been scared of that ended up not being scary at all? First thing I would say to you, Benjamin, is when there genuinely isn't, obviously, you know, I mean, I've had a few MRIs and the music that I was offered to listen to was Muse. And I chose Muse because it sounds exactly the same as the noise that the MRI scanner is going to make.
Dang, 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 dang.
Exactly that. and sometimes they offer you films to watch. You can't actually hear anything, but there is obviously...
Films? How can you watch a film in the MRI scanner?
They just like show pictures to distract you, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, if the idea of it is worrying, then it's a worrying thing. So is there anything that you thought that you were scared of before it happened, then when it happened?
Well, can I say on the subject of the MRI scan, because I've had MRI scans, and I'm fantastically claustrophobic, and I discovered that the way that they managed to make it work with me was I found that as long as somebody was, because I went in head first because they were... I had back surgery, and I had to go in and then have my back done. What I needed was somebody holding my ankle. I needed to feel that somebody was still... I know that sounds completely nuts, but I need to feel that somebody was holding my ankle. And when somebody was holding my ankle, then I was okay. So often, things that you think are scary have a solution that may seem completely bananas, like listening to Muse, because it sounds like dang, 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 dang. That's the thing that they don't do, is they make a lot of noise. So I've had a lot of things that I have been very worried about that then somebody said, oh, if you do this, it will make it all right. And as I said, in the case of the MRI thing, it was fine. Once somebody was holding my ankle, I was fine. So that was a thing that I thought was going to be terrifying, but then in the end wasn't.
Claire says, this weekend I went to see The Fantastic Anatomy of a Fall. The even more fantastic Hackney Picture House. During the film, an instrumental version of the 50 Cent song PIMP plays a really important and recurring role, as you both know. A genius song choice, I thought. But it made me wonder, of all the songs in the world, how did they figure out that an instrumental version of PIMP would be so perfect? So here's the question. What processes do the filmmakers go through to get there? Any insight would be appreciated. And any other unusual but perfect movie song choices come to mind. You will know more about this than I do, but when we were talking about Last of Us earlier in the year, I was listening to the Last of Us podcast, and Craig Mazin, who wrote it, said he rang up, he had somebody who he knew who had an encyclopedic, I have think I've told this before, an encyclopedic knowledge of music. And he said, I need a track for my two, this is the episode three, I need a song, two characters. It needs to be a song that they can play on the piano, and it's a sad song about falling in love. That was the brief.
Wow.
The guy rang back. It took 90 minutes, I think, and he called back, and he said, Long, Long Time by Linda Ronstadt. And Craig Mazin, who hadn't heard it before, listened to him and went, there, that's it. And so,
wow.
Who knows, the processes will be many and varied. But in this particular case, there was a specialist who knew what he was talking about.
Well, the music research, the person who's in charge of music licensing, that is a huge part of movie production. I can tell you two stories. In terms of Anatomy of a Fall, and it's the Bacow Rhythm and Steel Orchestra who play the instrumental version of PIMP. And in fact, in Anatomy of a Fall, when you hear the song at the beginning, it's going on in the background. You don't know where it's coming from. And the scene goes on and the song gets louder and louder and louder and then starts playing again and they have to cancel the interview. And the next thing is you discover that the song was coming from upstairs in the attic and the husband appears to have fallen from the attic window. And during the court case, somebody actually points out that the song is an instrumental cover version of a song which has misogynist lyrics, because they are trying to allege that this is an undercurrent that the character played by Sandra Hüller would have picked up on, that she was being taunted misogynistically by her husband, who was trying to interrupt the interview that she was doing with a female journalist. And therefore, that's another reason why she probably did it. And she says, but it's an instrumental. It's just a song that he liked to listen to, and he liked to listen to it loud. That's how he relaxed. So there is a whole point, there's a plot point in there about what that song is. So I am pretty certain that what would have happened is that Justin Triet and her co-writer, long-standing co-writer, would have known exactly what song it was they wanted. And they probably, in that case, would have, I imagine, checked out the licensing rights before pursuing that particular line. And I will tell you another story that I was told about Trainspotting, which is that one of the people working in the editing, it might have been the editor of Trainspotting, so forgive me if I'm misattributing it, I think it was the editor, was working on the overdose sequence. You remember the famous overdose sequence in Trainspotting? And they put Perfect Day on it, and they cut the sequence to Perfect Day, and they showed it to the producer. And the producer, Andrew and Kevin MacDonald,
both of them, bless him,
said, "It's brilliant. If you show it to Danny, I'll fire you." The reason being, we can't afford it. It's absolutely perfect, and if you show it to Danny, we will have to have it, and we can't afford it. And the story then is, they did show it to Danny. Danny said, it has to be that. And then, of course, what they managed to do was to do a deal with Lou Reed. But that there are many cases in which somebody has written a script or has been in an editing room and has cut. If you ever see French Connection, the car chase sequence is cut to Black Magic Woman by Santana?
Yeah, or Fleetwood Mac, they did a version as well.
Okay, it's the Santana version it's cut to. And it's really weird, because if you watch it with that playing in the background, Jerry Greenberg literally cut it to that, and you can see that he did. And you can see that there are times in films when the song that they really wanted, they didn't get.
Thank you for the question. Dora says, have you ever listened to a person talk for less than a minute and known you weren't going to get along with that person?
Oh.
And what did they say?
Well, okay. I think you should go first on this. Because
I suppose sometimes someone might say something that is so objectionable, you just think, I'm not interested. I'm going to walk away, or if you're in a car.
So if they say something like anti-Semitic or something misogynist or something, within, you just go, okay, fine.
It depends. If you can do something about that, like Matt Chorley at Times Radio, who he tweeted this week that he'd been in a taxi, and the guy had said, what do you do? He says, I'm a journalist. And he went on into a huge, long anti-Israeli rant. And I won't go into the specifics of the conversation. Matt, in the end, he ended up getting chucked out of the cab. You know, Matt said, well, in which case I'll leave. And the guy stopped anyway. So, if you're in a position that you can leave a conversation, then obviously do. But I think that's not what the focus of the question. I would think it's more the manner in which the person is talking, which takes us back to Saltburn. And and I think maybe if I'm analysing it, Warwick University Rugby Club, who I'm sure maybe now they're very lovely, but back in the day they were not. And every time any of them appeared, it was just made me want to vomit and disappear and leave and just think, no, I'm sorry, but and you take great pride in the fact that their sweatshirt had a W and an anchor on it. And they thought that was obviously hilarious.
Hilariously funny.
It's the entitled hoorays louder than in all those people that Emerald Fennell has captured so well in Saltburn. I think it's that kind of entitled conversation that just makes me think, I know you've only been speaking for 20 seconds, but I have already judged you.
So I would say there's a very famous sketch by Stuart Lee called These Days, if you say you're English, they can lock you up. And he tells this story about he gets into a cab and the cab driver says to him, these days, if you say you're English, you know, they can lock you up. And Stuart Lee goes, so sorry, but sorry, if you say you're English, and the guy goes, anyway, so I'm not going to, you should watch it because it's a very, very good routine about cab driver says something completely outrageous. And Stuart Lee just keeps repeating it back to him until he finally confesses that it's absolutely not the case. In terms of the thing about prejudices, I'll say this because I grew up in a very certain period, and I grew up in a period of the first series of Spitting Image, right? One of the Spitting Image songs that we all knew when we were young was "I've Never Met a Nice South African," okay? And we all say, you know, because it was apartheid and all that sort of stuff.
And it's an accent that we can approximate.
It's an accent that we can do an approximate. And I was basically one of those people who was brought up to hear that accent and make absolutely sweeping generalizations about what people who spoke with that accent was.
It's kind of like the white Afrikaner.
Afrikaans, yeah. Yes, exactly. So that kind of, yeah, which I'm not going to do a version of. I have recently been to South Africa for the first time. I know you've been before. Enjoyed the company of people who had that accent, who were, you know, really smart, intelligent, people who would say things like, listen, you know, you want to know about what the Brits did? But I realized that I had a prejudice. In fact, funnily enough, when I went, you sent me a text which was referring to that. It's been good because we were of a certain age. My prejudice against that accent was nothing other than a prejudice. I mean, I know it was absolutely nothing other than a prejudice because you cannot judge people by their accents. You shouldn't judge people by their accents. It's completely wrong. And anything that is prejudicial is wrong. That said, posh people swearing loudly on trains.
Instant judgment.
And I'll tell you for why. It is the sense of entitlement. Emerald Fennell's got quite a cut glass accent. I mean, she played Camilla in The Crown.
Okay? And very well.
But she doesn't come across as having that, you know, entitled sense. People who feel that they have the right to talk, and I speak as somebody who's got a loud voice, people who feel that they have the right to swear in public whenever they want because they own the place, I find infuriating. And I invariably find it more infuriating if they're posh. Because there is something about that, you know, oh, effing hell, Jeffrey, it's just like but every part of me rails against the making that decision on the basis of an accent. And
even when it's the correct decision.
Yes, because I do fundamentally feel that you shouldn't be able to prejudge anybody on one. I'm not saying I don't. I do it all the time. But I also think I have friends who are pro Brexit, and I don't have a problem with that because I think if you stop talking to everybody who doesn't agree with you, I don't think that's a good thing. I really don't. But and yet I am one of the most prejudgmental people I've ever met. I hate the fact that I do it.
It should also, this might be interesting or not, entitled people are not, it's not the same as being posh.
There
are posh
exactly. People
and there are some entitled trade union leaders I've heard over the time. You know, you're thinking, okay, you're just assuming that this is all good. You know, they're making all those assumptions. I've met football supporters who are entitled. You know, it's not necessarily a huge thing. You can be entitled in all kinds of different areas.
Well, there is a sense of entitlement in the taxi driver. You get in and if he feels entitled to go off on some anti-Semitic rant. You're stuck in their cab and they are entitled to tell you what they think.
Yes.
To which the answer is, whatever Matt ended up with, stop the cab, I'm getting out.
Have we got time for one more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want a kind of a cruel one, but it's lighthearted and okay.
Yeah, fine.
Okay. Well, this is from Martha. Who is the best example of you don't need talent or skill to make it in life? Which I'm afraid to say, this is obviously, again, we're making judgments here. I wrote Matt Hancock. Because my initial inclination is to, you know, if you write, most politicians that you despise actually have a skill, you know. So we're talking about people who actually have no skills.
Well, I think the classic example is George W. Bush. And yet, here is George W.
Bush. The good old days.
And there, in a nutshell, is the thing, isn't it? Is that George W. Bush was an idiot. I mean, he was a useful idiot, but he was an idiot. He was somebody who was being worked from the foot by people around. You know, that's what we've seen various versions of that on screen. He was an idiot who got to where he was because of his family and all the rest of it. He had no oratory skills. He was the man who said, you know, I know how hard it is to put food on your family. You know, just a buffoon, a fool, an idiot. And yet, I have found myself longing
for the good old days.
For the good old days in which a Republican president was able to be as close to being a functioning human being as George W. Bush was.
How about Prince Andrew? Did he qualify?
He hasn't succeeded, though, has he? I mean,
he's made it in life. He's a prince.
He hasn't made it in life. He was born into royalty. He seems to have done everything possible to.
See, the thing is, if you've made it in
that mateless interview.
Yeah. Maybe influencers.
Oh, yes.
Maybe them. I'll put all of them. Anyway.
All influencers.
Thanks very much for all the questions. Keep them short and they're likely to get on. We'll tackle some more next week. Send them, please, to correspondence@kermitandmayo.com. Take one and take two with you on Friday.